Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In this show, we talk wine with the wine masters of this year's MSU Billings Foundation Wine and Food Festival. We meet up with Ewan Proctor of Penfolds from Australia and John and Lane Gier of Matchbook Wine Company from California. Proctor is the brand ambassador and head of luxury education for Treasury Wine Estates of America, while the Gieres once owned R.H. Phillips to now Matchbook. We learn about Grange, the most iconic wine from Australia made by Penfolds. We learn of the winery's histories. We learn of blending wines and wine and food. Now, you represent wineries that are steeped in history. Can you briefly share with the listeners how the wineries you represent came to be? So this is a brief history lesson. We're going to begin with John and Lane. Matchbook's beginnings started in the 1970s. I read that John, you and your brothers, were adventurous boys growing up in the area south of Sacramento in Dunnigan Hills with an interest in fire. From fire, you went to wine. How did this come to be?
Well, we've always been involved in agriculture. Our family moved there in the 1850s from Quebec, Canada. And so the wine business was just evolution from traditional agriculture of the area. And the area had at one time a history with wine dating back to the 1870s. But with phylloxera and with prohibition, the area went to other crops. So our venture back in the, actually 1981, with R.H. Phillips, was the new beginning for Dunnigan Hills, a region that sits about 40 miles as the crow flies from Napa Valley. And so we spent the last 36, 37 years developing the viticulture and what works in that region.
Well, you established R.H. Phillips and that got sold. And so you ventured into something new after that.
So we sold that in 2000. Worked for the company for 5 years during our non-compete with the idea that we wanted to continue in agriculture. So we moved 6 miles away from R.H. Phillips and started Matchbook. We started as a kind of retirement brand. I think I was 47 at the time when we sold. And so we just wanted to create this small little 5,000, 10,000 case brand and have fun with it. And the realities of the wine business came to pass, and we knew we had to really either be all in or all out. And so we decided to go all in, and we spent the last 14 years building the company to what it is today with 6 brands and doing Spanish wines and doing some wines from Russian River Valley. So a diverse wine company as opposed to just a wine brand.
Well, you went all in. Lane, how did you get into this all in?
Well, when we came back from college to farm, John and I met in high school, and when we came back to from college to farm the property, we farmed to wheat and sheep, and I just jumped all in with that, and together we built up R.H. Phillips, and together we're building up Matchbook.
It's great to have a partnership like that. Ewan, Penfold started in 1844 with founders Dr. Christopher and Mary Penfold with sherry and fortified wines to Clarets and Rieslings, and today with Grange, a Shiraz-based wine reigning as probably one of the most prestigious wines in the world. Why don't you give us some history about Penfolds?
You know, the history's almost a similar timeline if you think when John's family moved down from Quebec in the 1850s. That was around the same time that a lot of people actually were moving around the world. And so Christopher and Mary Penfold, he was the third or fourth son of a medical family from the south of England. And I think he felt that his opportunities might be a bit limited where he was growing up and bigger in the new and relatively undiscovered lands around Adelaide in South Australia. So South Australia, it's important to note for South Australians, South Australia was a colonial settlement, but it wasn't a convict settlement. So South Australia is the only state in Australia which never had convicts, and it was set up as a free settling state. And I think as a result, it was very attractive to a young couple who wanted to go out there and start a business and start a family. So as you mentioned, they moved out, purchased about 500 acres, just 8 kilometers or 4.5 miles, 5 miles outside of the actual very center of the city of Adelaide. So our home vineyard, which is called McGill Estate, which is still there, is literally just up the road from the downtown of Adelaide. And so it's a great place to visit. these days. It's steeped in history. We still have the original winery buildings there, and those are the fermentation vats that you see there are the ones that the original granges were made in the 1950s by Max Schubert. Yeah.
It's great to keep that history because I think age actually makes wine better, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely it does. And that philosophy that of blending that came out of being principally a port and sherry house was very influential in the creation of what we call our house style of winemaking. So that still we do find a lot of common thread right back to the start of our history. Yeah.
Well, in some ways, you've now touched on my next question, and that is philosophy. So I will start with you. What is the philosophy of Penfold Wines?
Well, definitely there's several tenets of it, but one of them for sure is the maintenance and development of the house style, particularly in the red wines. And that house style could be defined as something that is quite bold, yet as well somewhat refined within the Australian wine landscape. Always a focus on quality and reputation for cellarability, so wines that will improve in the cellar. And in fact, when we talk about our red wine portfolio, that's really what Max Schubert was setting out to achieve when he started to create Grange, is he wanted to create a wine in Australia that was cellarable. He felt that most Australian wines didn't improve with age and weren't being made in a serious fashion. So he got inspired, actually, after a trip to Bordeaux and to Spain, and came back to Australia to create that wine. And that now influences the rest of our portfolio still to this day.
It is definitely one of the most collectible wines in the world these days.
Definitely. And from Australia, we're very proud to have that wine as an icon of what's, I guess, the collector's market. There's not that many other Australian wines, if any, which are part of that international wine trade of collecting wines from 30, 40, 50 years ago. So very, very proud of having Grange in the portfolio.
Lane and John, what is your winemaking philosophy?
Our whole venture is about discovery. Because we don't have a long history of grape growing in the Dunnigan Hills, we're still trying to figure out what works. And I think that really shapes wine style and really the future of our wine program. If you had to sum it up in one phrase, it's about power and grace. That's our slogan that we use. We're trying to make powerful wine, wines that aren't all about extraction, but finesse with extraction. And we're trying to figure out the clonal selections that would aid us in that wine style. So for instance, with Tempranillo, which we grow on the farm, we have three different clonal selections. And we're really looking for wines that we can grow and harvest at lower maturities that are powerful. Because if you can get lower maturities, you have less alcohol, less harsh tannins. And so that's what we're really focused on the red program.
Right. I think the key to our philosophy is we are new. When we started R.H. Phillips, there was a lot of skepticism that we could grow grapes where we are. We proved with R.H. Phillips that we can. And with Matchbook, we really started this company with the idea that we want to prove out the quality of the area, plant the right clones, make wines, really show the quality of their area. So every year we're constantly experimenting with vineyard techniques, winemaking techniques to improve the quality but keep the same price points.
That must be very fun, actually.
It is.
Just to have that ability. You have your history, and yet you can play around a little bit these days.
Well, one of the things that allows us to do this is we're completely 100% estate focused. So we grow everything that we make for the primary brands. And so it allows us to plant and experiment. And in the wine business, it takes so long to plant a grape and then see it through to an actual wine. So we simply don't have the time to experiment with small lots. So we do it on a pretty large scale and take the risk if it's going to work or not. So we'll do, if we're experimenting with something, we're planting 10, 15 acres of it so that if it works, if it hits, we're able to move it to commercial production right away.
That goes back to your all in. You have to be all in.
All in.
There's definitely a movement to bring wine and food together. In fact, this week at the Montana State University Wine and Food Festival, we're bringing wine and food together. What are your thoughts about wine alone and wine and food together? Ewan, why don't we start with you?
That's a really good question. Definitely, I think, from a Penfolds point of view, if we're looking at where we are and why we are where we are, that whole thing of Max creating Grange in the 1950s was in instigated by that trip that I mentioned, but also by his recognition, I guess being a second generation European immigrant, so he's Maximilian Schubert, he was German, and wine was a part of the table for German people, but it wasn't necessarily a part of Australian culture. And Max recognised that post-war immigration to Australia was going to change the landscape of wine production and principally mean that port consumption, which was sky high, was probably going to decline and table wine production was going to increase. So that part of this modern era of Penfolds, where we're a wine company, is very much influenced by this idea of Europeans coming to Australia, I think, and dining with wine. And so we've been through now a few generations of that, and we've got a very healthy wine and food culture in Australia. Wine surpassed beer probably about a decade ago as the favourite drink of Australians. And I think that's gone hand in hand with, you know, greater confidence around what we do with food in Australia. Because we are such a young country, we haven't really developed an identifiable Australian cuisine that we can put to people, but we have an incredibly complex and diverse landscape, and that means a lot of influences from Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of immigration from Vietnam, from China, from the Philippines, from Indonesia, so there's this incredible influence of those kind of flavours in Australia. As a result, Australia also has a very diverse winemaking landscape. So Penfolds obviously stands for a lot of tradition, but still we do experiment. Unfortunately, we don't always get our experimental wines over to the United States because they're made in very small volumes.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I think the experimentation with new varieties is definitely leading to those wines which are kind of more of a standalone drinking wine, whereas, if I'm being honest, the core of our portfolio is still very much a food wine base.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so our wines tend to favour, you know, traditional matches. Now, I've come up with some pretty crazy ones along the way in my career.
Such as?
Well, I spent 3 years in China.
Yes.
And famously, Chinese cuisine has been, I think, a little bit misunderstood in terms of its pairing with wine, because it's been quite sort of a convention in the West for us to say, oh, well, Chinese food, because it's got spices, what are the things should be better with sweet Rieslings and Pinot Gris and things like that. And it's not necessarily the case when you see how it's consumed. Definitely strong flavors in wine are appreciated, and so that actually helps us a lot. But one of my favorite matches is actually our tawny ports with Sichuan cuisine. So when you're getting into really crazy Mala spice, one of the best things you can have actually is a really strong flavor like a port.
Yeah. To help tone it down and yet come together as a good companion to the food.
Yeah, so with Sichuan oil and really famous like fish dishes from Sichuan, actually ports are really wonderful as well. Yeah.
Sounds wonderful. Mm. Lane and John, what do you think? A wine alone, when wine and food come together?
Oh, that's such a great question. When we started R.H. Phillips in 1981, there really wasn't a wine and food culture at all. And so all of us in California and Australia, we were all working it was sort of a pioneering effort to bring wine to the table and make it part of a meal. And it's so interesting to be a part of that at the beginning, and now that it's really become part of the culture, part of the table, farm to fork food with wine and the pairing. And it's been exciting to see all that come together and become part of everyday life.
Yeah, I love that combination.
I'd also say in our area, it's kind of the organic capital of California, a little region called Cape Valley. And that's where the movement started, that started feeding Chez Panisse and in Berkeley and the restaurants in the city. And so we kind of have that as part of our food culture. And then on top of that, our family grew up in the sheep business. And so morning, noon, and night, we had lamb. Every which way. And as a kid, I never got to eat beef. It was always lamb. That's transcended and come into our culture at Matchbook. And it's our house dish, lamb chops with any assortment of red wine, but principally Tempranillo, our Spanish wines.
It sounds like the Shiraz could be a good match for the lamb also.
Yeah.
When pairing wine with food, think of wine as just another ingredient to the dish. My hint is to look at the spices and seasonings first. The general rule of white with seafood and red with red meat is a good one, but does not always work. But don't overthink things. I believe your taste buds will tell you when something is delicious. Now, in the second part of flavors, we will ask our wine masters what their definition of a good wine is. Ewan Proctor talks about the wine named Grange, a Shiraz blend, one of the most iconic wines ever made. Then we hear about what's happening next for Matchbook and Penfolds. Welcome back. In the studio, we are talking John and Lane Giguier of Matchbook Wine Company and Ewan Proctor of Penfolds Wineries Company. In the first half, we learned of the winery's history and then talked about wine and food. Now, I pose the question of what makes a good wine. A wine's popularity with the bottom line of sales can be heavily influenced by the ratings of Wine Spectator, Wine Enthusiast, and the Wine Advocate. So what is a good wine, according to these experts? We hear from John Giguier.
Well, certainly ageability would be one of the factors. But I would say intensity and balance. We're striving to make wines that not only taste good, but feel good on the palate. In California, we're going through this transition from softer wines to highly extracted, sweeter wines. And now there's a movement back to wines with more finesse. And we certainly, as a producer, are headed in that direction. So that elegance is really a big factor. And away from show wines. And unfortunately, show wines are what get the reviews still. But maybe, hopefully, reviewers in the future will move more away from that and acknowledge that great wines can be made that aren't highly tannic and need 15 years of aging before you can drink them.
That hedonistic definition. Lane, did you have something to add to that?
Well, I think John said it correctly. I think the real great wine is all about balance.
Ewan, I see you shaking your head agreeing with what they said. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think John kind of nailed it there. Especially in the timeline of the shifting trends or eras within production, particularly in New World places like California and Australia, where we have been through some decades of very highly extracted wines and which potentially lacked finesse for a while. And I think going back to your previous question, that also made those wines less friendly with food. Mm-hmm. I think the realization that food and wine going together also sometimes depends on some restraint on both accounts. The same can be said of a dish as well. If a dish isn't in balance, it can be amazing and mind-blowing on one level, but perhaps overpowering on another. And I think the realization that to get real harmony, it does sometimes require restraint in the cellar or in the kitchen to create something that really lets room for other flavors and other things to emerge and to develop. Yeah.
Before we continue in the next section of my interview, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Penfolds' most famous wine named Grange. It is touted as the original and most powerful expression of Penfolds' multi-vineyard and multi-district blend of Shiraz, with a tiny addition of Cabernet Sauvignon to be aged in American oak barrels. I've had the opportunity to taste this wine, and there is nothing like it. This is one of those wines that evolves as you drink it. You taste several flavors on the first sip, and then something else when you sip again minutes later, and then more nuances as time passes. On the Penfolds website, a bottle of 2014 Grange sells for $900, and I want to read you an excerpt of the tasting notes for what you experience when smelling the wine. Umami. Expressed primarily via wafts of shiitake mushroom stock, hoisin, and XO sauce. Enhancing scents of dried aged beef and game meats. Then there's olive leaf, cardamom, sage, and thyme. A stroll through the South Australian olive grove. On the palate, the tasting notes continue to describe savory, not fruity. Taste, flavors remind of slow-cooked beef ragu, chicken liver terrine, red licorice also apparent. Integrated oak, spicy, almost non-American oak, but it is, as it always is, a core of 100% new Quercus Alba. Now, let's go back to Ewan Proctor. So let's get into specifics. Why is Grange, and why do you think the world thinks Grange is such a great wine?
I think it's a unique and distinctive style that was created sort of 60 years ago that we've maintained a tradition on. So what that means is there's an unbroken line of over 60 vintages making the wine in the same fashion as to when it was first produced. We've weathered some criticism over the years. You know, in the 1990s, a lot of people thought we should transition to using French oak, so we'll use American oak on Grange, 100% new American oak. It's a very bold statement. And in a time when that wasn't fashionable, we kept Grange the same. So Grange really stands for a tradition, and that means that the collectability of it, I think, is always intact. You know what you're getting with Grange. It's not just about to change on the whim of a new winemaker or anything like that. So I think that's a big part of what makes a wine like that attractive from a collecting standpoint. Taste-wise, it's, yeah, again, very distinctive because it is one of the really sort of great wines of Australia based on Shiraz. It puts Australian Shiraz firmly on the spotlight. And that, to be honest, at the time, a kind of a risky proposition. There wasn't a Shiraz wine like that out in the world at the time. So
I think, in my opinion, is that I think a great wine has not only balance, and it's more, I liken it to a song. It's not just one note. There are many notes to that sip of wine, to that drink of wine. And it's how you as the composer add those notes to it and the tones and the sound to it. You have that ability as the makers of these wines. So what is next for Matchbook Wine Company? You've gone through many chapters of change. We somewhat talked about that, but what's next for you in the way of new products or expansion?
Well, we're at the stage, we're now 15 years into this company with another 22 years in the previous company. So we're just trying to take what we've done up to date and refine it, make it better. Part of our wine program is really based on blending. So we have an incredible amount of blending component, and that gives the winemakers a lot of freedom to create. And so in terms of components, I'm talking about clonal selections of the same varietal. On our Chardonnays, we'll have 6 or 7 clones planted, same with Cabernets. So that gives diversity. And then we have the latitude to blend in 25% other than the varietal. And so we have a lot of blending components that would never see a varietal wine like Tannat, like a Teraldigo, a Northern Italian variety. And so we are also playing, for instance, on our Spanish portfolio, Portuguese varieties. Triga Nacional and Sauso are two that we're really looking at strongly. And so the winemakers are always looking to build the blend. And we have a very hands-on approach. Some people talk about hands-off, let this fruit speak for itself. Our philosophy is really intervention, which in a lot of worlds would sound bad.
You're nurturing.
We're nurturing. So we do things like stage, where we take the juice off of the fermentation and put them on the skins of another variety to help extraction, always cognizant of tannin and seed tannin in particular. But that helps us kind of shape the master blend. And so we give our winemakers a lot of freedom. Everybody that works as a winemaker is given the title as winemaker, not assistant winemaker at our winery. And so it's very interactive.
Okay.
Do you mind if I add something to John's point there? I think John makes a really great point about the freedom that you can give a winemaker in blending. Blending is very important at Penfolds. It's part of our house style. And I think it's somewhat misunderstood in an era where people are very interested in terroir. But even from a single vineyard, you're most likely to be blending different components. And so blending never leaves winemaking. The art of blending is intrinsic to winemaking. And I think it's very important that people still realize that even our single vineyard McGill Estate Shiraz is picked in 4 lots. And to finish that wine, you still have to blend those parcels together. And you might declassify it some, and you might elevate some to Grange. But there's still blending going on even in a single vineyard wine.
But that's good to know, because we do have that perception that you take grapes from one vineyard, you throw it into the barrel and ferment, and from there you make the wine. But to make your style and to keep it consistent and to keep your message out there, you do have to do some finessing to make that wine.
Even on a single vineyard wine, certainly, as you said, that sort of composition of something like Grange, which has got so many parts, is a multi-regional blend. So we're looking very far afield, but the blending aspect, and that what John was saying about the freedom of blending and that gives a palette of colors for winemakers to play with, that exists in a single vineyard, in a regional wine, and also in a multi-regional wine.
Yeah, and our experience has been, you know, most of the time the main varietal that you're using may not have everything you want, and like cooking, you want to add some things in. That's why we've developed our program with a lot of blending components, both different varietals and different clones within a varietal.
Yeah, because some wines may have a certain type of fruit or have more tannins or have, you know, just different components is that you can actually put together.
Yeah, and each vintage, you get something a little different. And so it's never the same in terms of one year it can be one variety and another year it could be another variety in terms of what you're adding to the master blend.
And that's where the fun and frustration probably comes. Ewan, I'm going to have you get into what's next for Penfolds. I see that you're producing a sparkling wine, a champagne.
Yeah, so this week we just launched our collaboration with Champagne House called Champagne Thiernot. The Thiernot family, a very entrepreneurial family from the Champagne region. They also own some chateaus in Bordeaux and a distribution company in France. And several years ago, they became our distributor. And I think that was the beginning of a long-held ambition from our chief winemaker, Peter Gago, to bring sparkling wine back to Penfolds. Penfolds was actually quite a large producer of sparkling wine in Australian history. We had a separate brand called Minchinbury, which was very household name until it was all wound up in the early 1990s. So we haven't produced a sparkling wine since then. But Peter, actually, who is now our chief winemaker, when he joined Penfolds, he was the sparkling winemaker. So I don't think he ever gave up the dream. And for him, as he's trained in making sparkling wine, and again, blending, very important to the house styles of all the champagne houses, I think there was a lovely symbiotic sort of alignment there after we became distributed by a champagne house, and they've been very kind in opening their cellars and allowing Peter to create three new wines. So there's a cuvée, Pinot Chardonnay, that have been released last week, and then next year we're looking forward to a Blanc de Blanc and a Blanc de Noir, all from the 2012 vintage.
Well, it's very, very exciting. Of course, I love sparkling wine, and I always think that it's a great celebratory beginning to all meals and all gatherings.
I definitely ascribe to Madame Bollinger's very famous quote about drinking it when she's happy and drinking it when she's sad, and when she's thirsty, she drinks it, and when she's not thirsty, she still has a little sip.
You should have brought a bottle for us today.
Yeah. It doesn't actually ship in the United States until June 1st.
All right.
But well, I bet it's, you know, if someone wants to try it, you've got to be quick. There's not a lot of it.
Okay.
Otherwise, we'll be waiting till March for the Blanc de Blanc.
Well, exciting. All right, final word, John and Lane. Sometimes I think wine drinkers are a bit insecure in their choices. You know, I often hear, I don't drink that much wine. I don't know that much about it. I like Cabernet. What advice would you give our listeners as to how they can continue to enjoy and grow their wine drinking experience?
I think that's such a good question, because I think that's something, a perception that we've been battling since the very beginning. There shouldn't be any stigma of what you like or don't like. I think if you like something, enjoy it. And if you have a glass of something and you really don't like it, don't drink it. Move on. And I think that's why all of us are making so many different types of wines, so many styles of wines, because people like so many different things. Just drink what you like is my advice.
I like that advice. Ewan?
Well, I think that's a perfect sentiment. I'm firmly behind the democratization of wine and that it should be for enjoyment. I'm very much a devotee of Bacchus. So if it brings you merriment and helps you unwind or enjoy time with your family and your friends, don't think too hard about any sort of consideration of, is this the right wine, or is it the right vintage or the right variety? If you're enjoying it, it's a good thing.
Well, we may just end on that note. Cheers to you. Thank you so much for being here at MSU Billings and helping us raise scholarships.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
When you take your next sip of wine, I encourage you to listen to your own palate. You know when you like wine as you say yum to yourself. Notice that smile on your face and palate when you taste good wine. I raise my glass to cheer you, the listeners. Many thanks again to our wine masters, as their time and expertise helped the MSU Billings Foundation Wine and Food Festival raise $380,000 this year. Theme music for Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region, has been provided by Parker Brown. Additional funding has been provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanians. Thank you, listeners, for your support. I'm Stella Fong.